Sound check.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cletus Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 267 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Superman 78, number 4, Wonder Woman Black and Gold, number 6, Aquaman Green Arrow Deep Target, number 2, Checkmate, number 6, Deathstroke Inc., number 3, Robin, number 8, Action Comics, 1037, Detective Comics, 1045, Catwoman, number 37, Teen Titans Academy, number 8, The Flash, number 776, Supergirl, Season 6, Episode 20, Kara. Titans, Season 3, Episode 12, Prodigal. Why the Last Man, Season 1, Episode 10, Victoria. And The Flash, Season 8, Episode 2, Armageddon, Part 2. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news. The Naomi television series premieres Tuesday, January 11th, and to mark the occasion, DC will launch a second six-issue limited series on sale March 8th. Naomi Season 2, Number 1, begins the character's quest to uncover the truth behind the new mysteries around herself and her powers, and it will define her place in the DC universe.
I mean, certainly no surprise that she's getting a second series. It was obviously meant for that regardless, but I mean, we talked about when we reviewed the first one that it felt like it was being created for a TV show that succeeded. And naturally, when you're putting a TV show out, you want the next comic to come out. So, yep. Big shocker all around.
Yep. Makes sense. All right. Up next for DC News, Shadow War Alpha Number 1 Special is releasing Tuesday, March 29th. And it kicks off a three-month crossover event between Batman, Robin, and Deathstroke Inc. DC promises Joshua Williamson's epic crossover will have major ramifications for the DC universe.
I mean, I'm not shocked that Batman would transition straight into another event because, I mean, why wouldn't you, Drew? It's not like we've gone event. That's fine. I will say, based on, and we'll get to it when we review the Deathstroke Inc. comic, but I'm not shocked that this is the obvious. Obviously, they always say this will have massive ramifications. But in this case, it makes sense because we also know that Josh Williamson has his fingers in whatever the next event is. And I think DC-wide event, that is. Whatever's going on in Deathstroke Inc. is definitely connected to that for sure. So I'm not shocked that this Batman one would tie into whatever big grand plan that Williamson has in general.
Yeah, it's no surprise to me either. All right.
Plus, everyone loves Batman event comics, so it's just it's a win for everybody.
I think the fans know where we stand on event comics at this point. All right, up next for DC News, WB Games has announced a brand new Wonder Woman video game. The game is described as a single-player, open-world action game that will introduce an original story set within the DC universe. No other details were announced for the new video game, such as a release date, platform, or relationship with other DC video games.
This is pretty, pretty exciting news, Drew. I wasn't expecting it, but I'm very curious.
I am too, and they didn't really give us any information on anything. I'm wondering what stage it's, if it's at the beginning stages of development, or are they further along, but not far enough that they can tell us anything?
I would imagine they're not very far along, because I think if they could show something significant, they would.
That's true. If it was farther along, now that I'm thinking about it, they probably would have introduced something at DC Fandom.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And we also know they still have two video games that are coming out within the next year or so. that still aren't out yet. So resources have been focused on getting those done. I don't know if it's the same studios necessarily, but still, I'm not. I don't. I for there are many reasons why I don't think this is that far along. But that being said, very, very excited and curious to see what kind of game it is.
Me too. All right, for our next bit of DC news, Total Film Magazine features a cover story on Dwayne Johnson's Black Adam in the latest issue and has released some images of Dwayne Johnson in his wardrobe as Black Adam. In two of the images, Black Adam is wearing a dark, ragged cloak, not unlike the old wizard in Shazam, while the third image seems likely that he's doing a battle scene. He's in an anti-hero outfit with no cloak and a bluish color that is likely used for Black Adam's lightning effects.
It's definitely a pretty cool look. It's very reminiscent of the Gary Frank character model that they had from the New 52 Shazam reboot, which makes sense because the Shazam movie pulled from that. It's a great look both for Shazam and Black Adam. So I definitely like the costume. I did have to roll my eyes a little bit, Drew. I don't know if you read some of the quotes that were with that, where he was like, the original suit had a ton of padding, and I had to rip it off. And it wasn't until there was no padding left that the suit felt right. And it was like, I believe that you believe that, Rock, but like, come on, man. We all know that you're big and muscular. You don't need to tell us that.
That's funny. I didn't read those comments, but that is funny.
Yeah. A again, it was they're fine. It was just I had to roll my eyes a little bit. It was like, yeah, dude, I get it. You're jacked. Your suit doesn't have any padding. Great. Okay. You know who else is huge? Is Henry Cavill, and his suit had some padding in it too. It didn't really bother me at all, Drew, because I also know that Henry Cavill is a large man. So it didn't it was fine.
I agree. All right, and for our last bit of DC news, a new Superman suit has been revealed for Superman and Lois Season 2. The most notable changes are the boots that have a different design that a more comics accurate V shape at the top of the boot. The suit also appears to be featuring brighter colors, particularly the red. There's also less muscle padding, and the overall effect is that the suit looks more streamlined and more like the classic comics.
Yeah, it's a massive difference. I mean, you look at it and you're like, wow, so much more Superman.
When I first looked at it, I was like, I didn't notice that much of a change except for it did look brighter colors, but there wasn't that much of a change, I didn't think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I will say it's reminiscent of the Flash. Obviously, when they switched from that darker red to the regular bright red that Flash should have, that was a pretty big change. But then beyond that, Flash has always had sort of slow incremental changes to the costume. Arrow had that a lot, where obviously they had a couple times where there were major costume differences, but for the most part, they were always just like slightly refining it, making it a little bit more comics accurate. Obviously, still, trying to make it wearable for the actor. So it's nice. You could have told me that the costume didn't change at all, and I would have believed you. So,
All right, well, that wraps up our comic book news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
hello, I am the monster of the Monster Sci-Fi Show. You may be confused, but I am the superior version of the monster, and not just some variant. Much like me, this podcast is burdened with glorious purpose. I'm here to say this podcast delivers timely sci-fi and pop culture news plus movie and TV commentary reviews. In the end, is this not simpler? Subscribe to the Monster Sci-Fi Show. It's sci-fi. From a certain point of view, the Monster Sci-Fi Show is part of the ESO network.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers. 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 We got spoilers. Spoilers. For you. We got spoilers. 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 We've got spoilers. Spoilers. For you. For you.
All right, let's talk Superman 78, number 4. Inside the bottle city of Kandor, Jor-El retires from his duties on the council and passes them on to his heir, Kal-El. During the celebration, Kal-El is confronted about housing, dynamic exterior time, static interior time, and marriage. Kal-El tells Jor-El he sticks out like a sore thumb. He may have been born in Kandor, but he's from Smallville, and he knows wheat fields and football, not official dinners and politics. Kal-El wants to go back to Earth, and he wants to take all the Kryptonians with him. In Metropolis, at Lex Luthor's secret hideout, Lex tells Lois when Superman is finally defeated, the victory will belong to Lex, not some extraterrestrial interloper. Lex uses a transmitter that establishes communications via an alpha wave projector. Lex planted a receiver on Superman last issue before Brainiac took him away. Lex calls Superman and Lois talks to him. Brainiac detects the transmission to the bottled city of Kandor and traces it back to Earth. Brainiac returns to Earth. Brainiac decides that humans are too dangerous and need to be preserved and cataloged. So Brainiac takes the city of Metropolis.
I thought this issue drew, again, as the series has done so far, did a pretty good job of adapting that specific version of Lex really well, where he is smart, right? He is the you know, intelligent Lex Luthor that we're familiar with in most versions, but also, like, not that smart. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a little bit more of a flaw in his intelligence than there is in other versions of Lex, and we see that in the movies, and we see that here, where he figures out, obviously, something very smart, figures out a way to communicate into the city of Kandor, which Jor-El is obviously impressed by and needs, but also not smart enough to realize that that's going to draw Brainiac's ire and get his own city bottled. I thought that was a really accurate characterization of that version of Lex.
I agree with you, because the version of Lex from the movie, he's not the chess master. He's not several moves ahead. He, like you said, he's smart, but he doesn't think things all the way through. So that's where he usually fails. I am enjoying this series a lot. It does feel like reading the comic does make me feel like I'm watching the movie character. So I really like that about this series.
I agree. I've enjoyed the comic. I will say it does in other way. It feels like a movie in that the plotting is a little bit quick, which for a comic is a little disappointing, because I feel like it should have more time to let the story breathe. But it feels very movie-esque in the way that the plot is just really kind of skipping along. We get, like, what, 3 pages of seeing Superman live in Kandor before we're moving on?
Yeah, something like that. So, you're right, it is fast-paced. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Wonder Woman Black and Gold number 6. Our first story is called Role Model, written and illustrated by Margaret Savage. In the near future, Diana is having tea with a friend of hers that Diana has been watching over during the years. The woman has helped make changes for a better world while Diana had her back. Diana's been to many places and many times. She's been supporting, inspiring women and talented girls. Wonder Woman will always be there, ready to help the next generation.
This was fine. It was another one of those ones that, like, it gets a good aspect of the Wonder Woman character, but, you know, it was fine as a story.
Yeah, agreed. Our next story is called The Prophet, written and illustrated by Liam Sharp. The artist is having dreams about Amazons. Berchta, in particular, who was banished for killing a fellow sister. Berchta was the daughter of an opposing queen who had died in conflict. We see that the artist's wife moved out with the kids because the artist posted stuff online about the dreams. All his friends are gone, but he had to let people know. As the artist is leaving a message for his therapist, Diana appears calling him the name Prophet, asking how she may serve and protect this realm.
Very interesting story, Drew. Obviously, the artist is supposed to be pretty clearly supposed to be Liam Sharp. I really liked I don't know how you say, I don't know if it was, I thought it was maybe Brecto is how you said it. I don't know, whatever. The wild Amazon, I was very interested in her story and kind of seeing where that story leads, because we know we're going to get more somehow. The having the, you know, version of himself in the story does feel a little weird. Like, it's interesting, Drew. I like how he's playing with the comics format and where, like, a comics artist is dreaming stuff about comic book characters, and it's also him. It also felt a little weird, too. I don't know how to describe it, Drew. It didn't totally sit well with me. I don't know if I don't know if it was because it was Wonder Woman and these female characters, and you've got this male artist writing a fantasy story. It was kind of like, this is a little weird that you're putting yourself in there.
It was different, I'll give you that. One of the things I got out of the story was he having dreams, or was he having visions from the multiverse? At least that's the kind of take I got from it. And I got to tell you, I really liked his artwork in the story.
Yeah, I would agree on both those counts. I think that's a good question, Drew. I don't know if... I think part of what he's getting at, and we've seen other, like, one of his writer partners, Grant Morrison, has had hit on this idea before, too, where, like, comic book artists and writers who have these ideas and dreams or whatever of comic book worlds are really tapping into the multiverse. You know what I mean? It's like, it's an idea we've seen before. But it's always interesting. So I get definitely wanting to revisit it. He's doing it in a slightly different way. I'm very curious to see more of this story, and I'm glad that we're getting more somewhere. I don't know if he's doing like his own standalone Wonder Woman story. Is he gonna do another one in another black and white or black and gold issue? I don't know. That didn't seem clear to me. But I'll be curious to see whatever version of this story comes around.
Yeah, me too, because I was very interested in the villain they were portraying. So, and at one point, he was even saying he was seeing the visions through her eyes. So that was kind of interesting, too. So I'm hoping we see that villain again. All right, our next story is called A Lesson in Truth, written by Michael W. Conrad, illustrated by Noah Bailey. A man has taken hostages. He met Wonder Woman when he was a kid, when his family was taken hostages by the Yellow Mask gang, who wanted information technology from his father. Wonder Woman saved him and his family, but his parents died 1 month later in a car accident. The man made some poor choices, including squandering his family fortune. Wonder Woman tells the man it's not too late to change into the man his father knew he could be. Years later, Diana shows up at the man's book signing and tells him she is proud of him for the great work he has done since his parole.
This was a good story, Drew. Again, I like, you know, as many of these stories highlight that Wonder Woman can certainly take care of, you know, issues and problems physically with her fighting abilities. And we see that in this story, right? He talks about being a little bit scared of how powerful and strong she is when she's attacking the people who tried to threaten his family. But then also the diplomatic side of her, the compassionate side of her, can solve problems another way too. So I liked how this story kind of highlighted both sides of that.
Yeah, because we see Wonder Woman talk him down and hand over the gun to her. So yeah, I like how they portrayed both sides of that also. And I like how they wrapped the story up with Diana, you know, checking back in on him in his later life. So, you know, kind of following through on making sure he's okay like that. All right, and our next story was called Attack of the 50-Foot Wonder Woman, written by Christos Gage and illustrated by Kevin McGuire. Giganta buys a spell from Clarion the Witch Boy that gives Wonder Woman's powers to Giganta and Giganta's powers to Wonder Woman. Giganta struggles between saving herself or her new adopted town of Westville, Ohio. I like this story because we got to see things from Giganta's perspective, because she has to make the decision to be selfish and get away or to save this town. She's kind of, in a short amount of time, kind of grown attached to.
Yeah, I agree. I agree, Drew. It was a good story from Gigana's perspective. That was kind of refreshing. I don't know that I've personally read a lot where she's the main character, and it was very brief, and I kind of wish we could have seen a longer story. I get why it's not, and I'm not criticizing, but like I kind of wish we could have seen her deal with Wonder Woman's powers more, because I think it would have been a pretty interesting story. But that being said, what we got was great. I really liked the art style of the story as well.
I did too. All right, and for our last story, Fresh Air in Philly, written by Dr. Sheena Howard and illustrated by Jamal Campbell. The earth air is toxic, and people must wear gas masks to breathe. Wonder Woman and Nubia confront Poseidon, who has a gem that turns water into polluted air. Poseidon is punishing humans for polluting his waters. When Nubia threatens to cut off Athena's head, Poseidon gives up the gem.
Drew, I really, really enjoyed the art style of this comic, and the plot I thought was a pretty cool idea. I don't think the story was bad, but I do think it suffered greatly from only being like 5 pages long. And again, I totally understand why that's the case, and I know that they don't really have any control over that, but man, it could have used a lot more time to, I think, better develop the story, because like Poseidon's plot wasn't super clear to me initially what exactly he was doing. Like, I obviously he was responsible, right? We didn't know exactly what it was, and it seemed to be tied to the necklace, but like, what exactly was the necklace doing? You know what I mean? Like, it didn't make the story bad by any means, because there was a lot to like, but it's a bummer that it was only as long as it was.
Yeah, it was pretty short. I had, of course, I had read it. I had read it through once and then gone back through when I did my notes. So I had picked up that Poseidon wasn't happy about humans polluting, and he was trying to punish them. And Wonder Woman and Nubia were trying to stop that. But I agree with you. It was kind of too short for the, it needed to be a little longer and go a little more in depth on what was going on. And I'm guessing because Poseidon gives up the gem when Nubia threatens to cut off Athena's head, I'm assuming she's some sort of love interest for Poseidon. But I can't remember the Greek mythology if there's any behind that. So I was kind of wondering about that. But yeah, I agree with you. This story could have been longer and gave us more depth. All right, well let's move on to our next title for this week. Aquaman, Green Arrow, Deep Target number 2. Arthur and Oliver are on a plane owned by Oliver Queen. They're heading to Star Labs to figure out what is happening to both of them. The plane is attacked, hit by a pulse cannon on the orders of General Anderton. Arthur tells Murray to get them over the water. Oliver goes to the outside of the plane and repels pulse blasts with his trident. In the cabin, Arthur is firing arrows at the three men in suits who have boarded the plane. Their arrows are ineffective against their armor. Arthur gets a trank dart fired at him, but it misses. Arthur realizes these guys want to take them alive. Arthur runs into the cockpit. He throws an explosive arrow into the back of the plane. Arthur jumps out, holding on to Murray and his parachute. When the parachute fails to work correctly, Oliver uses his powers to slow down their descent with water. The trio makes it to the shore. Murray informs them that the pilot had taken them off course, and he's not sure where they're at. A villain jumps from the plane and sends the trio flying. Murray breaks his neck and is killed. And the villain asked Oliver if he remembers this island. A lot was going on in this issue, Cletus, and some of it was a tad confusing. I wish they would have given us a little more details on what's going on. I understand they're trying to keep it sort of a mystery, but that also made it just a tad confusing.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I don't remember Aquaman being able to control water. I thought that was Mira's thing. Is that just me, Drew?
No, that's not just you. I don't remember him being able to do that either. He usually talks to fish. So, controlling a water thing, I've seen Mira do that before, and I've seen Jackson do that before. Of course, their powers are sort of similar. I've never remember Aquaman doing that, but that's something Poseidon can do also. Maybe the writer's confused on what Aquaman's powers are.
Yeah. But yeah, anyway, Drew, I do agree with you. It's very fast paced. It definitely seems to be much more of an action oriented comic. I don't know. I think I would like a little bit more plot development, as you said, but we are where we are, I guess.
Yes, and it's obvious the island they landed on is the one that Green Arrow was trapped on. At least that's the feeling I got. They haven't come out and said it, but that's what I'm guessing they're going to reveal next issue.
Yeah, I would agree.
All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Checkmate number 6. Talia al Ghul fights Checkmate. She wasn't really working with Mark Shaw either. Talia wanted the Heroes Network for herself. Tala is able to teleport away. When everyone is evacuated from the Hall of Justice, Leviathan agent Whitney is told to make her move. She aborts the mission because Green Arrow is there. Mark Shaw is in Metropolis on a private airfield with Lois Lane and Damon Rose. Damon Rose takes out Mark Shaw. Lois calls Superman and sends him to the Hall of Justice. Superman notices Damon looks just like John Kent. Mark Shaw is teleported back to Leviathan headquarters, where there is a coup. Mark Shaw is no longer the head of Leviathan, and Mark Shaw is dead. At the Hall of Justice, Mr. King has shut down Leviathan's technology. And one thing I wanted to insert here was they didn't really say how. They never really told us how he was able to do that. And if he was able to do that, why didn't he do that before? But that's beside the point. Superman goes to Markovia to learn that Mark Shaw is dead. Markovia has fallen, and the Heroes Network is safe. Checkmate has decided Leviathan is not gone, but evolving. Amanda Waller shows up out of nowhere and reveals that Mr. King is really Commandy from the future. Waller states that Checkmate will now answer to the Justice League. And I don't know about you, Cletus, but that seems weird that Waller would want Checkmate to answer the Justice League instead of her. That just felt not like something Waller would do.
Felt like that was being written by somebody who doesn't understand Waller as a character. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, agreed. Talia al Ghul returns to Leviathan. Nakamura tells Talia that everything is invisible to the Heroes Network and Superman's powers. Leviathan will reveal itself again when they are ready to reveal themselves. For now, Talia wants to introduce her new team to the Lazarus Pits. Now, like I said, Waller showing up, that was just freaking weird.
And willfully having Checkmate be run by somebody other than her with no checks and balances put in, like, fine, the Justice League can run you, but I get this in return. Some like that's again, that's being written by somebody that does not understand that character. And then I just gotta say, Drew, this was, I think, a kind of the ending kind of fell on its face. I mean, we knew, obviously, you and I knew that Mark Shaw was going to lose because they had made that clear from comics that were supposed to come out after this one. But his defeat is kind of lame, right? Like, it just kind of comes out of nowhere. We don't really see, I don't feel, Drew, and maybe I'm just not remembering the rest of the story well enough. I don't feel like we see a clear buildup to his people mutinying on him. I feel like he's the clear leader, has strong control over it, and then all of a sudden, right at the end, they decide, no, actually, you know what? You're not right for this, and we're gonna kill you. That
That's,
felt like it came out of nowhere.
yeah, it came out of nowhere. The other thing that wasn't clear is because the comic seemed to indicate that Leviathan might have killed him, but then it also indicated that he was shot by the Damon Rose and maybe that wound killed him. They were unclear about that. And I have to agree with you that the Leviathan turn on Mark Shaw didn't feel right. They didn't build to it right. And Talia al Ghul being behind everything, they didn't build up to that very well either. It's like they decided at the last minute that's what they were going to do or something.
Part of me wonders if something changed with what the story was supposed to be. I don't know, man. It didn't really work because, like you said, it's really unclear how exactly. It's fairly clear it's his people that kill him, but does Damon Rose actually use something that gets, or does his people like disconnect his technology and that lets Damon Rose get a shot in on him? You know what I mean? Like that whole scene is very confusing, and I do not understand which way to interpret that. Does Lois Lane's brother get have something up his sleeve that Mark Shaw is not expecting and does something to him? Or is it entirely the Leviathan people shutting down Mark's tech?
The comic also said it was Mr. King that shut down his tech, which I thought the reveal of it being Commandy from the future was weird. The introduction to Waller was weird. I'm wondering if you're right and they changed something, and that's why we got the weird ending we got. Because it looks like they're leading into another story into the future on this. Like, they had decided that they were going to end the story here, but something changed, and now they're going to tell something else in the future. After reading the ending of this, I'm sure that Leviathan is going to come back at some point. But the other thing I wondered is if Leviathan turned into the Trust we're seeing, too. Because we don't know who the head of Trust is or what.
No, I see. I don't think that, Drew. I actually feel very confident that's not it.
Okay, good. That was just the thought that had crossed in my mind. But I'm sure we'll see Leviathan again in the future. They just set it up to be that way. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Deathstroke Inc. number 3. Deathstroke and Black Canary have captured the Queen of Fables. Canary takes the Queen back to Trust, while Deathstroke goes inside the magic book to capture Cheetah, who's created her own fantasy world. Deathstroke's guns have disappeared, but he still has his sword. Deathstroke rides a unicorn to the castle. Deathstroke must battle Cheetah's 100 soldiers before he can finally make it to the castle. Deathstroke battles Cheetah, and he rips a page from the fantasy book, and Cheetah's make-believe world disappears. Cheetah tells Slade if he lets her go, she'll tell him the truth about Trust. Dinah questions Juliet about what is being done with the villains they are capturing. Juliet tells Canary that they're being turned over to the proper authorities. Canary doesn't buy that and follows Juliet. Canary learns that Toyman is also suspicious of Juliet. Canary is spying on Juliet as she's talking with an unknown person. Juliet wants to bring in more heroes because when the heroes win, there will be balance in the multiverse. Then Juliet reveals a costume that is blue and gold that contains a staff with the balances of justice on it. And I know I've seen that costume before, Cletus, but I was unclear where I'd seen it from. I was thinking it was from some sort of Crisis or something.
Indeed it was.
Was it from the original Crisis?
I don't think so. The one I know for sure that it is from Final Crisis.
Oh, okay. I knew I had seen it before. Black Canary calls Oracle and tells her this mission is so much bigger than Batman's stolen technology. Canary thinks she knows who Trust is. Canary loses her signal with Oracle right when Babs tells her she needs to take out Deathstroke, who happens to be standing right behind her with his sword drawn.
Well, we know that they're not going to fight next issue, Drew. They're going to be on the same side. That sort of tease I don't like, because we know that he's not about to kill her. We just saw him talk to Cheetah and learn that he's being played.
I know.
So the big reveal, I think, Drew, with this is the Libra costume that gets revealed towards the end of the issue that Black Canary stumbles on and recognizes who that is. And that is why I'm very confident that this, whatever's going on in this, is tying into whatever Williamson's trying to do with his big DC-wide crossover. Because we know that Darkseid and the multiverse is the big thing there, right? Big threat. And Libra was the agent of Darkseid in the lead-up in the early parts of Final Crisis. He was, you know, like one of his big right-hand men. Is fairly famous for murdering Martian Manhunter in that story. So that's very interesting. And it's really the last time I think that he's been seen since that big crossover. So I'm kind of curious to see where we're going with that.
That's all interesting. I'm curious to see where we're going with this too. Of course, we know it's going to be leading into a big crossover with Batman and Robin in a few months, so I'm sure that's where the story is going to be heading next. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Robin number 8. Damian and Hawk fight to the death. Damian loses to Hawk. Master Dusk proposes an alliance between the League of Shadows and the League of Lazarus. United, they can finally change the world. Mother Soul states that they will be unstoppable. Suddenly, all the contestants are surrounded by ninjas. Mother Soul announces that no one will be leaving the island ever. The destiny of this tournament and this island is to feed the pit the deaths it needs to be fully charged to unleash the demon that sleeps within. Once the demon possesses the world's mightiest fighter, the Avatar will be given the immortality promised. Damien interrupts Mother Soul, stating the tournament isn't over yet until he says it's over. Hawk states that this is why he joined the League of Shadows. He's the only one who can stop the demon. I'm glad that's why Hawk decided he was going to join the League of Shadows, was to stop that demon, because from what I gather from the story, he had no clue that demon was in there.
Yeah, well, he certainly doesn't when he gets stabbed through the chest right at the end of the story, too.
Yeah, that too.
We've seen that Williamson is trying to tap into some manga and anime influences with this. Obviously, we see Damien literally reading one. The fight sequence felt extremely reminiscent of action sequences that you get in manga. So that was a cool idea. That being said, I think sometimes manga is somewhat infamous for stretching fight sequences out. A, it's cool, but B, also because they're ongoing stories, right? That the more issues there are, the more profitable the story is. And so that having the fight sequence be reminiscent of that was cool, but also like took up far more time, I thought, Drew, than it should have, because we were getting like some panels that were taking up space that I really didn't think we needed.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with you there. I noticed that the fight scene was kind of drawn out too. I didn't realize it was reminiscent of manga, because honestly, I don't read manga, so I didn't know that. So thanks for the insight on that. But I have to agree with you. It did kind of drag out the comic. And I'm sure, you know, this story is going to start leading into that big crossover Williamson's going to be doing too. So I'm sure this is going to lead into that somehow too. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Action Comics 1037. The United Planets Council has decided their help will only hinder Superman's effort to free Warworld. Also, if Superman should fall, would it be wiser not to anger the monster who felled him? Mongol tells his followers to kill Superman's vassals, but Superman is Mongol's alone to kill. Manchester Black tells June to take out the woman in the veil. June creates a giant green snake that eats her. Suddenly, the ground begins to rumble, and a creature with a gold metal plate over her head and sharp teeth swallows June. The rest of the Authority decide to help Superman take down Mongol, but a creature with ram horns begins to fight them. Manchester Black finds another creature who is controlling the ram-torn creature. He states he has implants in his mind and his body that protects him from telepaths. He also has an energy field that will repel energy blasts. He also shows Manchester Black an object called an orphan box that holds power beyond anything imaginable. Manchester Black beats him up with a bat. As Superman and Mongol fight, Mongol brags that he tore down his father's furnaces that fueled Warworld. Instead, Warworld is powered by star forges that produce radiation like that of a red sun. Leah Nelson tries to free a baby from a container when something grabs her and kills her. Superman comes to her aid, but it's too late. Mongol stabs Superman through his back with a kryptonite-tipped spear. The leader of the United Planets wants to declare Superman dead by the hands of Mongol and decides they should do nothing.
Very good comic, Drew. I mean, it just goes horribly wrong for Superman's team. I mean, it's just everything that could go wrong does. At least a couple members die. And then we get on the United Planets front. We already saw last issue that whoever the head of the council is here has some skin in the game that we don't fully understand yet. And the one thing I did question, Drew, was I felt like I like they tried to play it so that he was very diplomatic about getting them to not intervene. But also, like, no one on the council at the end of that was like, that was kind of weird, right? That he was this insistent, like, we do nothing.
Yeah, you would think somebody would start questioning his motives. And maybe they will in a future issue, but it didn't happen here. But you would have to think that somebody was start to be suspicious of not doing anything. So I have to agree with you, Cletus. This was really good, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of this story. Now, we also had a backup Martian Manhunter story called A Face in the Crowd. Martian Manhunter is eating a bowl of cereal with his cat on his lap when he sees a news story about pieces of an ancient artifact at the Metropolis Museum that catches his attention. At the museum, Martian Manhunter is staring at a painting called Lost that was painted by artist Kyle Rayner when museum director Gwendolyn Heath introduces herself. Director Heath tells John that the pieces of the artifact are being held in storage. 4 days ago, someone broke in and took them. Director Heath believes the pieces are part of a large bust known as the Idol Head of Dabalu. John states he's responsible for it being in pieces. Suddenly, the human flame interrupts their conversation, stating he didn't come here to learn, he came here to burn. I had to laugh when that villain showed up and stated that line, because the story went from sort of serious to kind of ridiculous with that villain.
Yeah, I did not care for the backup, Drew. I was excited because I was like, whoa, wait, Martian Manhunter backup? Are they actually trying to do something with that character? And then it was like, oh,
And that's all we got to say about that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Detective Comics 1045. Batman is able to resuscitate Mayor Nakano. He lives. Oracle boosts her signal and is able to contact Batman. Batman tells Oracle the tunnels are infested with a parasite in the larval form. Oracle gets the rest of the Bat family involved with solving the infestation problem. Mayor Nakano tries to blame Batman for not informing his office about the infestation. Batman tells Nakano that he thinks the magistrate has an agenda. Also, Nakano had an agenda against anyone in a mask being an enemy. The creature at the heart of this infestation worked in Nakano's office, Hugh Vile. Batman thinks Gotham is full of monsters that Nakano can't see. Batman fights one of the monsters. Nakano tries to shock it with a stun gun, but it's not enough juice. Nightwing steals a magistrate ship and blasts the monster with electricity. Back at the mayor's office, Nakano tells his assistant that they have some new information from someone who they are now coordinating with. The mayor wants to talk to Deb Donovan about city infrastructure. He will give her an exclusive interview for her trouble. Then Mayor Nakano wants to make a better list of the monsters in this city. Last issue, I mentioned that I thought Nakano and Batman might start working together or teaming up. And we see here that Nakano is interested in working with Batman, even though it feels like it's against his nature to want to do so. But we see that he's not fully committed working with Batman, but he is going to check it out because he brings Deb Donovan in. And I think it's, you know, to find out her story behind the infestation and what's going on. I just found it interesting that I was right.
Yeah, you were right, Drew. I will say, though, that this comic and then the Catwoman comic that we are going to talk about next, I thought both highlighted how frustratingly not on the same page the Batman books are, where, like, this book has been technically Fear State, but not really, right? Only just in that the magistrate exists and Mayor Nakano is a universal character being used in the stories. But, like, the Nakano in this story, Drew, does not match up with the Nakano that we've gotten in other stories.
You're right about that.
Even in within this one, he's often been portrayed as way over his head, right? Out of his depth. But in other stories, I feel like it's so he's so extremely over his head that he's inept at best as mayor and almost dangerously bad at his job. Whereas this one, we see he's just, like, naive, right? Doesn't full is blind to other stuff that's going on. Like, his hatred for suits is blinding him to other issues that are going on in Gotham. Which I would say is an interesting take, Drew, but, like, how dumb do you have to be to not realize that Gotham has other issues besides Batman? Even if you think Batman's a problem, how do you think that he's the only problem, Drew? I mean, are we serious? I don't know. I liked this story, and I liked the outcome in regards to this story, but it also doesn't really match up with what we saw, I don't feel, at the end of the actual Fear State story. I feel like the Nakano we get in this and the outcome we get in this is totally different from what was being implied in the other books.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. We also got a backup story called Foundations. After Batman contains the crazy man at the construction site of Arkham Tower, Batman does some investigating and discovers toxins. Batman gets infected and starts having visions of his parents and the Joker. Batman starts chasing after an old man who wants to destroy Arkham Tower construction site. Batman chases after him and runs into Harley Quinn. And it's to be continued. Me, I don't really care for this backup story that much.
Well, I mean, it's objectively bad. What's even happening in this, Drew? It's all over the place. I know this whole thing has theoretically been about this Arkham Tower, but what is going on? All of a sudden, Harley Quinn pops up, and she's like, hey, looks like you've been hallucinating. Anyway, let's have a serious sit-down chat and talk about whether I should use this wrecking ball or not. What?
I know. It's crazy. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Catwoman number 37. Alleytown, Gotham. The magistrate is retreating. Something has changed and they are going after someone else. Catwoman, Harley Quinn, and the Gardener are fighting two different versions of the Flickering Lady, each with different powers. Ivy is being transported to the docks. Nygma is coordinating with Billy. Nygma tells Billy he's got a welcoming committee waiting to greet them. Nygma gives Catwoman a riddle in which the answer is revenge. Nygma informs Catwoman he and Penguin are getting revenge on what she stole from them. Penguin now has Ivy and control of the docks. Catwoman laughs at Nygma and tells him he is so predictable. The Ivy that Penguin has is not really Ivy, but Clayface. Catwoman has her own team on the docks, and Nygma has been played. Harley Quinn and the Gardener get Ivy to safety, and Ghostmaker shows up in Alleytown to help.
Again, Drew, and this I'm hitting on the same thing here, but it frustrates me how not on the same page these stories are. And I will say, I prefer that these writers do tell their own stories, especially this guy who's been killing it on the Catwoman book in general, but also in Swamp Thing, in Justice League Dark. So I would rather him do his own thing. But then if you're just going to let them do their own things and loosely at best tie into what you're doing with the Batman event, don't do it. Like, just do the Batman story, have it just be its own story. That is possible, DC. I don't know if you know this, but you can just have a comic tell its own story without requiring six other comics to do it too. But if you're going to mandate, well, you got to do Fear State and you have to be doing what we're doing, then make it all mesh. Make it connect, Drew. Like, this is the worst way to do it, where you're, like, forcing them to tie in their story and derail what they're doing, but then you're also not really reining in, you know, control of the story that much, so they're still kind of doing what they want to do. You get this, what I feel is a mess of continuity right now within Batman, where you've got, like, three different kind of status quos that are going on that all don't totally align together the right way.
I agree with you, and I just have to think back into the olden days when there used to be Batman events, but, you know, they weren't every freaking one after another. Anyways, the editorial team did a much better job of keeping things cohesive and flowing from one, you know, like from a Batman to a Teen Titans book and then back again. You know, the story's they flowed a lot better together and stayed more cohesive and not all over the place, and were, like you said, they're tying loosely into the event. So, yeah, I have to agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Teen Titans Academy number 8. Parents and potential students are at Titans Academy for a tour and learn to more about the school. One of the parents raises a concern about the safety of the kids because Flash killed Roy Harper. When Cyborg states that Flash is no longer a member of the Teen Titans roster, nor a member of the Academy faculty, the Flash shows up with his two kids. Wally is at the Academy because he and Linda are interested in enrolling their kids at the Roy Harper Academy. Rachel is having apocalyptic visions, and she is worried that they are coming true this time. Red X shows up trying to disrupt the recruiting of new members. Greg, Marissa, and Matt steal the H-Dow from Miguel's room. They try to use it to contact Roy Harper, but it doesn't work. Roy Harper walks into the room wondering what happened to this place and what's with all the kids running around. This is another issue, Cletus, where we have a gazillion things going on at once and try to, instead of just focusing on one thing.
I agree, Drew. It's just, it's too unfocused, and it's moving at just far too fast of a pace, both in terms of actual plotting of the issue, it's moving too quickly, but also the like passage of time within this comic is ridiculous, Drew. Especially when you consider relative to the other DC comics, a year has passed in this book. I don't think a year has passed in the main DC books.
I agree with you. I don't think they have either.
I want to say that shouldn't really, I wouldn't normally really care about that, except DC, again, keeps wanting certain things in certain books to be tied in and to matter in terms of timeline and relevancy. So if you're going to do that, then you've got to keep things straight. My biggest problem with this, Drew, is that there's just so much going on, and it's moved so quickly. I still don't fully appreciate, understand, get some of the characters that are supposed to be main characters. Like, they mentioned Brick again, and I was like, oh yeah, Brick's a guy. I had forgotten that he even existed. We get Red X again after not having him for, what was it, 5 issues? And he sort of, it felt like he only kind of popped up to be like, oh yeah, by the way, Red X is supposed to matter. And then we get the thing that was supposed to be the thing that sets off all of Future State, right? That bad, sloppy Future State story. We get the event, right, that's supposed to unleash the Four Horsemen. And it seems like they don't. But it also kind of seems like they don't, just because the story's just like, yeah, we're not going to do that. So then don't. I don't know what to say, Drew. Just don't do that then. Don't get to that part of the story yet if you're just going to hand wave it away.
The other thing was weird was what was up with stealing the H-Dow, thinking that you're going to contact Roy Harper? Where'd they even get that freaking idea from?
Well, we know that that's the thing, Drew. If you remember Future State, that's the thing that unleashes that whole mess, right? They use the age dial. It doesn't work. Instead, it unleashes the Four Horsemen and everything that happens, all leading all the way up to that weird future Black Adam story, is because of that event.
Oh, okay. I forgot. Sorry. You could see that really stuck with me, didn't it?
Yeah. The other thing I want to get at, and I think is a fundamental flaw in the story, again, with the way that it is being told. I think there's a lot of potential with the story as an idea, but with the way that it's being told, Drew, the teachers, so to speak, the actual Titans, I don't know how to describe them other than, like, negligent to the point of danger, Drew. Like, they're so out of touch and unaware of literally every single thing that has happened in this story leading up to this. They still, again, literally over a year has passed in this story. They have no freaking clue who Red X is, and they've made no real attempt to figure out who it is. They almost let them unleash the Horsemen, right? And have no idea that it even happens. They don't even know that almost just happened. They've got Dane wandering around, who's now Nevermore, right? Like, they've got all this bad stuff that's happening right under their noses. One of their members almost helped Gorilla Grodd take over New York City. And they all just sort of, they're just sitting there twiddling their thumbs like, eh. it doesn't feel like a school, Drew. It feels like this is a setting and things are happening, but the people who should actually be in charge and should know what's going on are so removed from the story that it doesn't even feel necessarily like they're bad at what they're doing, which I think is what the story is trying to hint at, potentially. But they're so removed from the story that it feels like the writers just forget that, oh, yeah, that's right, Nightwing's supposed to be a teacher.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. And we even have Rachel having visions of Dane doing something bad, but they still don't investigate or anything or know what's going on. I have to agree with you there. They are not paying attention to what the students are doing at all. They're just kind of, the students are just kind of running amok.
I wonder, Drew, with this book, part of me wonders, if are they just doing this to lay the basis for an adaptation of it into a show, a movie, something? You know what I mean? Because it's so surface level. It feels like they're trying to get out all of these ideas and all of these things to just establish that these things exist. But they're not putting in any of the time, depth. Part of me wonders if this story is being written for something else to get made off of it.
That's very possible. I could see them doing a Teen Titans Academy show.
The problem is it basically already exists. That is what Young Justice is. So I don't know if they want to do like a different Young Justice. Are they going to have like, is Young Justice going to lead into them becoming the teachers and these cast members that they've created in the comic being the new student characters? I don't know. If it's only meant to be a comic, Drew, I don't think they're doing a very good job because it's just so shallow as a story and so bereft of depth of both plot and character. I have to imagine they're doing something else. Otherwise, I don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. I wonder, maybe they got a live action show in the works or, you know, in the planning stages or something. Who knows? But I could see them doing a Teen Titans Academy live action show. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week, The Flash number 776. Last issue, we saw The Flash trying to remove a glaive from the middle of the street. Heroes and villains alike were trying to remove it when finally an alien energy vampire named Starbreaker was able to remove it. Unfortunately, Starbreaker released Eclipso from the glaive and became possessed by him. Starbreaker flies off, and Dr. Fate shows up and pulls Flash into one of his portals. Dr. Fate informs Flash that he is in a two-dimensional causeway. They must act quickly. They need to make it to their destination before Eclipso can make his move. Then Dr. Fate turns to the reader of the book, telling us their fate lies within our hands. As demons of that realm find Flash and Dr. Fate, the reader must flip the book around following both Dr. Fate and Flash's instructions. Finally, the reader must go back in the book and find the glyphs that will unlock the doorway for our heroes to escape. Once the heroes have escaped, we find out they are in Gem World, where the Justice League Dark awaits and Eclipso has won. I love this issue of The Flash, Cletus, because it was similar to like a choose-your-own-adventure, but you were just following the instructions that the characters were telling you in the book about flipping your book around and stuff. And I thought it was kind of cool how they broke the fourth wall on this.
I thought it was a cool idea too, Drew. I liked how it was, again, it was getting you to interact with the medium itself, to take an active role in the story. It was a cool idea. I think the only downside, and obviously this didn't apply to you or I, right? Because we were enjoying the story. But I think the only downside to doing it specifically the way that they did, where instead of, like you mentioned, to choose your own, where the reader is kind of choosing what to do or not to do, this one, the characters are instructing you, right? That there's not really a choice. When they say turn the page right, you have to turn it right for the story to make sense and to also just frankly for readability. But what if you don't? What if you're off put by that? Or what if you're just, you know, a contrarian? You're like, I don't want it. And so you don't. And so then you're reading the story and then it kind of it breaks that sense of immersion, because they tell you turn the book right. You say no. and then the story turns right anyway. You know what I mean? Again, that didn't apply to me, but I do think that is a small flaw in telling a story that way.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see somebody saying, no, they want to do that. I got to tell you, though, I was excited to see the Justice League Dark at the end of this issue. And was surprised they ended up in Gem World. I'm curious to see where this story is going. I know I've been liking The Flash more than you have. But this is the kind of thing that I've been enjoying with The Flash, being an upbeat story and doing something a little different. So, like that a lot.
I like this one was a lot better for me, Drew. I think some of the early issues, they were so surface level. And I liked that they were easy, fun adventures that Wally was enjoying being The Flash. That was good. But it was almost too simple. Some of those stories I felt, Drew, early were almost to the point of too simple, where I was like, I want just like a little bit of meat on the bone. I don't need pathos, right? I don't need Flash constantly dour and wondering why he's even the Flash. I don't need that, but I needed something. I needed a little bit more depth. And I thought this, with it being, you know, with the interesting fourth wall breaking, I thought gave it just a little bit more, where it is still a light and fun story, but there's still something a little more interesting going on in the background too.
Yeah, and it's fun to see Flash team up with somebody different. I don't think I've ever seen him team up with Dr. Fate before, like on a one-on-one basis, so I found it pretty interesting. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and we'll come back. We'll do our DC television shows.
It was the dawn of another podcast. The Epsilon 3 is a dream given form. It's a home away from home for three guys to watch a 90s sci-fi classic TV show. Three guys with microphones over 3,249 miles apart, all alone in the night. The year is 2021. The name of the station is Babylon 5. The name of the podcast is the Epsilon 3. Veer, bring me a drink.
All right, let's talk Supergirl, Season 6, Episode 20, Kara. Supergirl comes back to the tower with one big revelation. Instead of saving people, they need to empower everyone to be the hero of their own life. That helps them realize that the key to depowering the Allstone, as well as Lex and Nixley, is to empower the entire world. When Supergirl gives her speech to the world, everyone goes from black and white to back to full colors. Even with the Allstone depowered, Lex and Nixley are still a threat. The Super Friends show up and ask for their surrender. Lex and Nixley respond by bringing in extra villains. Overgirl, Metallo, Parasite, Red Tornado, and some other monsters. Luckily for the audience, no cheesy cyborg Superman. The Super Friends fight these villains with the help of Mon-El, Wynn, James Olsen, the original Guardian, and Mrs. Danvers. When the monsters are defeated, Lex opens a portal to the Phantom Zone, allowing the Phantoms in. The Phantoms don't attack the Super Friends or the people behind them. They go after Lex and Nixley because they feed on fear, and there's no greater cover for fear than hubris. Lex and Nixley get taken into the Phantom Zone. The Super Friends attend William's funeral in their street clothes. John announces that the president has decided to reconstitute the DEO, now named the Department of Extra-Normal Operations, and to let them run it how they see fit. The story jumps ahead 3 weeks to the eve of Alex and Kelly's wedding. Kara receives a call from Kat Grant. Kat explains that she's returning to journalism as the new owner of Catco and wants Kara to be the editor-in-chief. The next day, we have the wedding, along with a duet from Kara and Wynn. After the ceremony, Kara, James, and Wynn grab a moment together to reminisce about their humble beginnings. After talking with Kat Grant again, Kara decides to reveal her secret identity to the world. The series ends with Kat interviewing Kara, Catco's new editor-in-chief, and revealing to the world that she's Supergirl.
Thank God it's over, Drew.
They did wrap it up with a nice, neat bow, didn't they?
I have so many things that I could complain about with this episode, Drew. My biggest one, though, if I want to prioritize, my biggest complaint is ultimately, if you're going to have Lex and Nixley lose that early into the episode, which I get because you want to focus on wrapping up the series and not necessarily wrap up that plot, what was the point of all of those subplots, Drew? What was the point of all of those stones? Like, I know what it really was. It was to eat up episodes, but why develop Nixley's character? Why give her that background and give, like, the potential that maybe she could be convinced or turned or flipped, right, and see the error of her ways? Instead, nope, just send her to the Phantom Zone. What was the point of the whole love plot between Lex and Nixley and how he actually genuinely felt that way? Or then, nope, just kidding, maybe he didn't, or maybe he actually did and then felt burnt, and then, oh, doesn't matter, send him off to the Phantom Zone. What was the point, Drew? That made, I mean, obviously I wasn't expecting anything less, but it really just emphasized the meaninglessness of the last, what, 7 episodes, 8 episodes?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, there was no resolution to that at all. We didn't find out any character growth between Nixley and Lex, really. And ultimately, it was just a quick, easy, get rid of them into the Phantom Zone solution.
What a waste of time. That was just my biggest thing. It's like, what a waste of time. Like, if that's all you wanted to do, why? Why not just do something else, or why do the episodes at all? I just didn't get that, Drew. I mean, and then I have other minor nitpicks. Like, again, the show, as it has done its entire run, can never resist just massively overblowing how great its characters are. In even, like, little subtle ways, Drew, that when you start to think about them, imply things that I don't think the show intends to imply. Like, at the wedding, Alex is getting ready, and her mom comes up to her and is like, "Oh, Alex, you're such a great mom. You've already surpassed everything I've done as a mother." Which, again, clearly is the show's writers wanting to reassure you that Alex is the greatest thing to ever exist. That's consistent with the show. I get that. And I get that they want her to be a great mother. And I'm not even going to disagree with that take. But if you start to think about that, Drew, if she's so great of a mom that she's already within what can't be more than a month or 2 months, that implies that her mom is not a great mom, Drew. I don't think the show wanted to imply that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I got to tell you, the battle scene, the ridiculousness of everybody showing up, including Mrs. Danvers, I was starting to roll my eyes.
Oh, and some of the lines were just so bad. Like when Alex is like, "You don't touch me without my permission." I was like, oh my God. Because, and again, you know what they're trying to hit on that social issue. And it's just like, I don't need, again, Drew, this is the magic of Supergirl. They managed to make things that I agree with them on just seem so unpalatable. Like that line made me gag. And I was like, but I agree. How can you, like, how do you have this power?
And Kara's speech about, let's make everybody a superhero.
Oh, God. Oh, and then that speech was so great that it instantly rippled across all time. Oh, my God. Drew, that's I think the thing that's driven me the nuts the most about this, and Flash in recent years has been equally guilty about this, where they're just like so in love with themselves as writers and the characters that they've made, that they throw out these unbelievably overblown things, and they're just like, yeah, this is legit. This isn't weird at all that we would say things like this boring, forgettable speech was the greatest thing anybody has ever said in the history of ever. My God, what an amazing speech. Don't you agree, viewer? I was telling my girlfriend this, Drew. It feels to me a lot of the time like the show is almost looking you straight in the eye and daring you to disagree with something it says so that it can jump down your throat as the bad guy. I feel like it almost like baits us, where it's like, I'm going to say the dumbest, most ridiculous thing I can, and if you disagree with me, you're wrong and you're a bad person.
That's exactly what it feels like, doesn't it?
I can't wait to never think about this show ever again.
What the one last thing I wanted to mention was the fact that Supergirl was revealing her identity to the world.
We do that. I saw coming a while ago, Drew. I think I mentioned it too when they were doing the Courage trial. That the answer that the show seemed to be hinting at was that she really needed to reveal her identity. So we felt that. I felt that coming for a while. I was not surprised by that development.
That is true. You did say that. You did say that during her trial, where she went back to the airplane thing. Because now that I think about that, yeah, they were hinting at her revealing her secret identity to the world. And I'm just wondering if they got that idea from the comic book, from Superman.
I think they did, but it also frustrates me, Drew, because we've seen multiple plots where it hinges on the idea that that is not an option. The major Lena Luthor plot from a couple seasons ago, again, hinged on the idea that Kara revealing her identity was simply not a solution. Right? And this is, it's both this show and, again, Flash, where I feel like recent seasons of the show have started to just ignore or willfully look over established precedent that the shows themselves have made. I'm not talking about comic stuff. I'm talking about the show itself, rules that the shows have established, both Supergirl and The Flash have just started ignoring them and doing their own thing. And again, kind of daring you as the viewer to disagree with them.
Yeah, agree with you. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Titans, Season 3, Episode 12, Prodigal. Rachel and Logan find Nightwing dead on the street. Logan transforms into a bat, and with his newfound bat friends, Logan picks up Nightwing and flies him to the Lazarus Pit. Jason returns to the Batcave and tells Crane that Nightwing is dead. Crane says they will save the city, but first they must destroy it. Jason tells Crane he will not help destroy the city, and Crane tries to kill Jason. Crane is having a daily chat with Barbara in her cell via a video camera. Crane tells Barbara that Nightwing is dead. Blackfire is stealing a car when Crypto finds her and brings her to Connor. Blackfire burns the Kryptonian dust off of Connor. Blackfire asks Connor to team up with her. When Starfire tells Blackfire the truth about her powers, Blackfire wants to go back to Tamarin to rule as queen. Blackfire asks Superboy to help her with refueling her ship. Instead, Superboy destroys it. Dick goes to Jason and asks him for help in stopping Crane. The Drakes try to leave Gotham with the help of Donna Troy. When Crane's GCPD soldiers stop their armored vehicle, Donna and Tim team up to fight back. Barbara escapes from prison and tries to reactivate Oracle. Crane regains his fear toxin for destroying Gotham City. Now, we called it last week when Rachel and Logan found the Lazarus Pit that Nightwing was going to be put in it. Because what other reason would we have the side story of Rachel and Logan finding the Lazarus Pit?
Yeah, I agree with you completely, Drew. The thing that also I felt conflicted on in regards to the Lazarus Pit part of the story was I was very excited to see Beast Boy turn into something other than a tiger for what's the second time total on the show, I think. And I know I liked that they talked about it and they kind of gave a plot reason for why that's been the case, so that was cool. But that being said, the plot stuff around him turning into a bat was ridiculous.
I have to agree with you. I thought the total thing of him turning into a bat was ridiculous.
I felt conflicted. So I was like, that's awesome that he's turning into a bat. The whole sequence of him, like the transformation, was super cool. I loved all of that. But the fact that bats were even there in the first place, which they tried to like explain as like, well, the bats sensed your compassion and love for Dick Grayson. That's why they showed up. What? And then the bats just carry him to like, Drew. Raven has telekinesis. Just have her float the body to the pit. Or just don't show us them lifting the body and just show us them lowering the body into there. That was so dumb in like an extremely avoidable way.
I want to bring up the fact, what was the point of killing Nightwing just to bring him back in the Lazarus pit? It's part of the story I don't even think we needed to have. I don't even see what the reason for it was.
Well, and they tried to kind of explain/hand-wave that away, where when he's working with Jason, Jason's like, how do I know you won't kill me? Because now I know what it's like to die. What, Drew? What? So he was willing to kill Jason before that, but now that he's died, he's like, yeah, you know, maybe I won't kill.
I don't
Come
know.
On,
that
man.
That's stupid. And the Nightwing I know wouldn't want to be killing Jason anyways, but I know this is a more violent Nightwing that we've had on this Titan show. But the Nightwing I know wouldn't be trying to kill Jason. The other thing I had a problem with, and it wasn't just in this episode, was what are they doing with Connor? Nightwing putting kryptonite dust on Connor. I don't get why he did that in the first place. Why it didn't make any sense to me. I understand Nightwing wanting to go off on his own, but it just felt wrong for his character to put kryptonite dust on Superboy. And I don't know what they're trying to accomplish with that. Because of course there'd be ramifications of Connor not wanting to be part of the Titans because of that. I don't know. I didn't get what they were trying to accomplish there.
Yeah, I agree with you, Drew. It felt, I didn't think that much of it initially, Drew, because I thought it was just I knew you were going to not agree with my plan, so I'm going to eliminate the potential issue with that by distracting you or, you know, taking you out for a bit with the kryptonite dust. But then the show made it seem much like it has since, I feel, gone on to be much more serious than that. They're like, Connor was very seriously affected by the kryptonite dust and not just like temporarily taken out. That's the part that's confused and surprised me, Drew, is the like how drastic they've apparently decided to make that action be.
Yeah, and then he blows up Blackfire's ship. And I understand you don't want her to go, but you're not going to win her back by blowing up her ship. That didn't make sense to me either, his choice on that.
Well, we do know he is only a couple years old, Drew, so.
So we got one more episode left to wrap up this season. So I'm sure we're going to have the big showdown, but right now the Titans are kind of split up, and I don't know how some of them are going to get back together. I don't see Superboy and Nightwing wanting to be buddy-buddy. So I'm kind of curious who's going to team up to stop Crane and what's going to happen with some of the other characters. Because it doesn't feel like they can go back to being one big happy family.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very curious to see how it all plays out next episode. Because I agree with you. I think it's going to potentially be a little ugly.
Yep, I totally agree with that analysis. All right, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. Why the Last Man, Season 1, Episode 10, Victoria. The episode opens up with a flashback scene of the Brown family and Beth having a dinner in a restaurant. We continue to come back to this dinner throughout the episode as more family drama is revealed. Nora and Roxanne ride horses up to Marysville city limits. They are looking for the town that has electricity and supposedly a man. Agent 355 has decided that Dr. Mann, York, and her are leaving tomorrow. The women have a going away party for them. We see that Agent 355 and Dr. Mann seem to be at the start of a relationship, and York ends up hooking up with Sonia, the girl he's been talking to. Beth and Jennifer are hiding out in a house trying to figure out what to do next. Later that night, Sam finds them and tells them they are being watched. Kim has a sexual dream about York, and when she wakes up, she decides she needs to find York to save the future. The Sisters of the Amazon ride into the town Marysville, and they demand that the women hand over the man. The women of Marysville fight back, and a gun battle ensues. Hero chases Yorick, Dr. Mann, and Sonya. Sonya shoots Hero in the arm, but Yorick is able to stop her before she kills Hero. Yorick and Hero are reunited. Another Amazon shoots Sonya in the head. Hero tells Yorick to run, or she'll shoot him herself. Hero kills the Amazon that shot Sonya. When Nora sees that Roxanne is going to be shot by Agent 355 and a lot of the girls are wounded and hurt, Nora surrenders. Roxanne gets pissed and throws a temper tantrum. Hero tells Nora that her brother is alive. When the Sisters of the Amazon return to the pool, Roxanne is pissed at Nora. Nora tells her she put up with men like her for a long time, chipping away at you until you become what they want. No more. And Nora pulls out her gun and shoots Roxanne. Yorick is in mourning that his sister is brainwashed and his mother is dead. Agent 355 tells the story of how her family died in a car accident and that she was the only one left. Agent 355 gives Yorick the choice if he wants to continue on their mission. Yorick does, but only if Agent 355 teaches him how to fight. Jennifer, Beth, and Sam have been taken prisoners by President Brown's former General Peggy Reed. Agent 355, Dr. Mann, and Yorick find a vehicle fully fueled. It contains a refrigerated storage, files for blood samples, sterilization equipment, and needles. Agent 355 find coordinates and a map.
Drew, I really, really hope this is not the last we see of this show.
I know, it's so good. And you called the downfall of Roxanne. I gotta tell you, when Roxanne ran out of ammo, I thought Agent 355 was going to be the one to take her out. I was surprised she let her go. Nora shooting her in the head, that surprised me. I wasn't expecting that. Kind of saw a change in Nora in this episode, where we find out her real name was Victoria, which was the name of this episode. This felt like a change for her character, becoming, I don't want to say more of the aggressor, but more of a leader or taking charge. And kind of breaking out of the shell she has been in.
I feel like we've seen that slow transformation, obviously, throughout the whole season. But in particular, once she finds I feel like the tipping point towards this outcome was when she finds out who Roxanne really is. We see her slowly start to progress towards, I think, to me, this felt like the inevitable outcome. I honestly, Drew, was not surprised that she was the one that killed Roxanne, because it felt like the next logical step, right? Like, she had been, in a sense, subservient to the guy in charge or the gal in charge her whole life, as she talks about in her speech. Like, she had been, you know, a right-hand woman to the president, and then she was doing the same thing for Roxanne. But for her to truly grow as a character, she's got to seize power herself. And we saw, frankly, the last two episodes especially, that she was, frankly, the more qualified leader to begin with. Roxanne, and I love this, Drew, because I talked about this last podcast. Roxanne's defeat felt inevitable to me because she was so ill-suited to be the leader of that group, right? She was charismatic, and she held the girls' attention, but as Nora talked about, really all she had was supplies and weapons, and that sort of kept everybody in line. She has no idea what she is walking into. Nora comes up with what probably also would have failed, but a different, probably less deadly strategy of attacking the town. And Roxanne just ignores it. It's like, it's a bunch of soccer moms. It's fine. And she just rides in with everybody right out in the open. And then again, has multiple chances to kind of understand that she has walked into a situation that she is not prepared for, and ignores all of the warning signs. And then gets her people massacred because she thinks that she cannot get past her own worldview lens, that she's the toughest person, that, you know, and again, this fantasy that she's created for herself, and doesn't realize she walked into a town full of former prisoners.
I know you said you expected Nora to take out Roxanne. I was expecting Roxanne to take herself out, and I was expecting Nora to take over the group, but I wasn't expecting her to pull the trigger. I was expecting Roxanne to take herself out just because she wasn't a good leader.
Gotcha. Now,
I'm curious, but I don't know if it spoils anything. Is the Roxanne character that relevant in the comics?
I can't even remember if Roxanne was the leader of the Amazon in the comics. There was a clear leader character like her. And honestly, their story goes on for a while. I wasn't expecting her to be gone at the end of the season. You know, it's been a few years since I've read the series, Cletus, so I can't remember exactly what happens. But I know the Amazons are in it for quite a while. Man, it looks like they weren't leaving anytime soon. It looked like Nora was going to be taking them over. I don't know how much their mission was going to change, except for I think she's more concerned about supplies and food and stuff like that and not taking out men that may or may not exist.
I can't. So what's going to be interesting to me, Drew, if we do get a second season, would be so we know that Nora knows because Hero told her that Yorick is alive. There really is a man out there in the wild, right? And Hero, I feel, would have motivation to go after him, I would think. But like you mentioned, Nora, I don't think would care, right? By far, her top priority is securing supplies to stay alive. So that would be interesting to see, because I agree, the Amazons are clearly sticking around, but to what end? What would they be doing in the future seasons? So I'll be so disappointed if we don't get more of the show.
I am too. And Yorick and Hero both think their mother is dead, but we know she's still alive. She's with Beth, and then Sam came back. He's found them, and I wonder what they are planning on doing with them next. I have a feeling that they were going to go out trying to find Yorick too. It seemed like the show was trying to line up all these different groups chasing after Yorick. Of course, at the end there, we see that the general that was working for the president before now has them captured. And it was unclear what their plans were. Then at the end of the episode, we have Agent 355. I think it's her group that's behind them having a fully stocked fueled vehicle with everything they need. Like she said, somebody is watching them, but to what end? Are they wanting them to succeed? Do they have other plans? I don't know. It's intriguing. I'm very curious to see where the show was planning on going next season. And like you said, fingers crossed we'll get to see that. But I have not heard anything more about the fate of the show.
It was a heck of a season, though, Drew. I will say it was a great first season. It would be even better if it got to finish its story, though.
Totally agree. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. The Flash, Season 8, Episode 2. Armageddon, Part 2. Despero tells the Flash that tomorrow is the beginning of the Flash's end. A tragedy happens that eventually breaks the Flash and sends him into madness. Alex hooks Team Flash up with access to the database at the tower. They have access to their database, including any information they may have on Despero. Frost asks Chester to build a weapon that can kill Despero. That goes against Chester's vow to be a pacifist, a vow he made after burning down his best friend's house by building a ray gun like Marvin the Martian. Barry goes to a bank robbery to investigate and finds out the on-duty security guard is being hospitalized for some sort of breakdown. Witnesses say that the security guard lost his mind and started babbling nonsense. Then the guard fired his gun into the air and everyone ran out. By the time anyone got back inside, the vault was empty and the guard was stark raving mad. And it took four officers to restrain him. Kramer tells Barry to turn in his badge and gun. He's been suspended pending an investigation for federal crimes. Apparently, evidence turned up from Joseph Carver that Barry was working as an inside man for him. Star Labs is being shut down because of a supposed radiation leak. Apparently, their radiation detection system was damaged. A concrete encasement is being built around Star Labs, and it's being demolished and the debris moved to a nuclear waste site. Barry has Gideon initiate holographic emitters to disguise the inner parts of Star Labs from the city workers. Then Gideon wipes all traces of the Flash from the database, including herself. Iris and Barry learn that Exeter is a psychic meta who controls her victims' minds and drives them crazy. The Flash tries to stop her, but she takes control of him instead, pitting him against Team Flash. When the Flash goes to stop Exeter next, she suspends him in the air with her telekinesis. The Flash is able to vibrate his cells to create lightning and take out Exeter. Once Exeter was in metahuman cuffs, the security guard from earlier in that episode recovered. Barry discovers that Joe died 6 months ago. Next, the Flash is on the news with a video of him attacking the city. Despero comes to take out the Flash after the attack on City Hall. Despero blasts Barry and puts Cecile to sleep. When Flash gives himself up to Despero, Chester and Allegra use a shield to block it. Flash escapes. Despero promises to end Flash. Alex gives Team Flash more info on Despero. Both Supergirl and Martian Manhunter are currently off-world. Barry goes to the Hall of Justice and asks Black Lightning for help. Black Lightning asks him what is going on, and Barry answers, injustice. Now, I wanted to ask you, Cletus, do you think it was kind of naive of Barry not to figure out that somebody is targeting him? I mean, it's so obvious to me as the audience, but I would have figured Barry would pick up on it with so many things happening all at once to him.
Yes, but the plot demands that he doesn't do that, Drew. I agree. I mean, I agree completely with you, but if we're being honest, the real reason he's not picking up on it is because that's what the plot needs, not because it's what actually makes sense.
It should make sense because we've seen things like this happen to him before. I don't know. I'm just frustrated.
Again, Drew, I agree, but this is my problem with the writing of both of these shows, Supergirl and this show, is that they ignore past precedent that's set. There are so many red flags here that point to Reverse Flash. Obviously, we know that there is some version of him coming on the show, and I do feel like we inadvertently spoiled that for ourselves as a side note. But there are so many red flags that point to something like that, Drew, like you're saying. But the writing on the show is ignoring that, I feel, intentionally, because that's what the plot needs. It can't have him realize what the answer is right away because they've got to fill 5 more episodes.
It's just frustrating, that's all.
Oh, no, I agree. Again, I'm not trying to defend it. I'm just telling you, like, it highlights the flaw in the writing, which is that for the plot to make sense, they have to have characters be willfully stupid. I mean, that's been, we've seen that issue since the Cicada character. So, yeah, I'm totally with you. It's frustrating and it's dumb, but it's also exactly what we've been seeing from the show. Again, the other thing that's really annoying me, Drew, with the quality of writing and the dialogue, just, ugh. How many times are they going to say the phrase level up? Oh my God, I get it. Flash is faster. You have established it. The status quo is established. Please, for the love of God, stop telling me 10 times an episode that the Flash has leveled up his speed and that other characters need to level themselves up also. Holy cow.
Yeah, that is getting old.
It's just bad writing. It's bad writing. It's one of those things where, like, they've come across the theme. Clearly the theme of this, right, Drew, was leveling up. And so because that's the theme, they're just trying to use that buzzword as many times as they possibly can in an episode. And, you know, again, with, you know, no regard to the quality of dialogue that produces. This episode was not as bad as Supergirl, so that was good. And I did watch it right after Supergirl, so I did not hate it as much. And my girlfriend even was like, yeah, I don't know if it's because we just watched Supergirl, but that wasn't that bad.
I have to agree with you. When I watched this episode, I thought it was better too. I wasn't comparing it to Supergirl, but I was comparing it to the previous issue of a previous episode of Flash. I thought it was a lot better. I like some of the stuff they were doing, you know, some of the stuff that was happening to the Flash that made sense. What didn't make sense is him not figuring out that somebody was targeting him. I would have rather him figured out somebody was targeting him, not knowing for sure who, and then trying to convince Despero, you know, somebody's targeting me. I'm not, you think I'm going to become this madman, but look at all this stuff that's happened. Somebody is targeting me. We need to work together to figure out who. But that's not the route they're going.
I like a lot of the idea behind this story and some of the stuff that they're doing, but the execution of it, I think, is going to ultimately drive me nuts, Drew, because I just don't think that the writing staff is up to the task. Like you said, I agree with you. I like Despero being a part of the story. I think they've done him pretty well so far. I like the idea of Barry's life getting picked apart in the background by some villain who we don't know yet. You know what I mean? Like, all that stuff is good stuff. But then it's just the actual execution of those ideas that is lacking. And what could be, I think, a really good storyline and a really good, couple of episodes, I think, is going to ultimately just be, like, passable, which is frustrating.
Yeah, I agree with you. Then at the end, that ending scene with Black Lightning. Black Lightning asks him what's going on. Barry answers, injustice. Are they trying to imply Injustice League?
Well, I don't even know, man.
That's what I thought of. I was like, why is he answering injustice?
Sometimes I can't tell if that's supposed to be hinting at something or if it's just bad writing or if it's both. It's the thing, like, when the show is this bad at writing dialogue, it's hard to read into certain things.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, so I wanted to shout out about the character Libra, who, again, we see that costume revealed in Deathstroke Inc., and I think is hinting at a lot of what Williamson is planning to do with his big story. So Libra actually first appeared in Justice League of America 111 back in 1974, but he's only in two issues and then disappears, and is, like, not used again for decades. And then Grant Morrison, having the encyclopedic knowledge of DC that he does, needed an extra villain for his Final Crisis story and was like, oh, what about this guy? Libra within Final Crisis is one of Darkseid's right-hand men and is one of his, like, agents on Earth kind of preparing for his arrival. It's very cool. And if you want to see the first time that he appears, it's very interesting. You can see why Grant is interested in using that character in a New God story from his initial appearance. But the real meat and interesting stuff is in the lead up to Final Crisis and then within Final Crisis itself.
All right. And for my shout out, I'm going to shout out about a Batman the Animated Series episode that I watch every year this time of year. And when this episode released, we're going to be having Christmas later in the week. So I'm shouting out about Christmas with the Joker, because I usually watch it at least once a year. it's one of my favorite Christmas episodes from the Batman the Animated Series.
That's awesome.
So me and my youngest usually watch it at least once every year or so, around Christmas time. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about tonight, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you can email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman the Detective, The Human Target, Justice League Incarnate, Wonder Girl, Batman Fear State Omega, Batman 2021 Annual, Detective Comics 2021 Annual, Nightwing 2021 Annual, Robin 2021 Annual, The Joker 2021 Annual, Justice League Dark 2021 Annual, Wonder Woman 2021 Annual, and of course, our DC television shows, The Flash, Batwoman, and the season finale of Titans. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go.
You sure this is necessary?
The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone? But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.